Welcome to Act 3. The pipeline runs itself now, and this show is proof of it. Let's open with the news, then spend the rest of the hour on the GitHub Actions foundations that make unattended Claude Code runs possible. Top of the list is Claude Code CLI version 2.1.204, shipped July 8th. It's a single change release, and it's squarely on topic for us. The changelog says it fixed hook events, not streaming during session start hooks in headless sessions, which could cause remote workers to be idle reaped mid-hook. ReleaseBot corroborates the July 8th date. Here's why you care. If your session start hook does real work, installing dependencies or warming a cache, that pause used to look like idleness to a remote worker, and the worker could get reaped right in the middle of the hook. Now it streams, so the run stays alive. Upgrade with Claude Update or the global NPM install and go back to keeping heavier session start hooks in your headless and remote workers. Next, the GitHub Actions Foundation itself, Claude Code Action version 1.0.166 from July 6th. The cadence in our window was busy versions 1.64 and 1.65 on the 3rd, 1.66 on the 6th, 1.67 on the 7th, 1.68 on the 8th, but only 1.66 carries itemized notes. What landed? It drops a buffered inline comment when it's already posted live, which stops duplicate pull request comments in unattended runs. It uses the modern NorPlea email for co-author trailers, so commit authorship is correct. It handles symlinked claude.md paths during the config snapshot. It preserves repeated addir flags in your Claude arguments, so multi-directory context survives. And it propagates curl failures in the install pipeline, so a broken install fails loudly instead of silently continuing. Pin the action to 1.0.166 or later, or just float at V1, and if you depend on multi-directory context, confirm your repeated addir flags now survive. Secondary but useful CLI version 2.1.202, July 6th. It added a dynamic workflow size setting in config, small, medium, or large agent counts, plus two OpenTelemetry attributes, workflow run ID and workflow name for workflow spawned agents. Those two attributes let you attribute and trace unattended multi-agent runs in your observability stack, which ties straight back to our observability episode. It also split the review commands, /review is a fast single pass again, and multi-agent review moved to /code review. So audit any CI that expected /review to be multi-pass. One boundary note from version 2.1.200 on July 3rd. The default permission mode is now labeled manual across the CLI and the editors. For unattended runs, set an explicit permission mode rather than leaning on a default that now waits on you. Here's the premise for the whole tutorial. A headless Claude Code run rides on GitHub Actions plumbing, and when there's no human at the keyboard, every one of these continuous integration primitives, every CI primitive is covering a failure mode a person would otherwise handle in real time. A human approves a step, retries a flake, notices a hung job, kills a runaway that's burning minutes and tokens, or spots a silent permission error. Take the human away, and each of those becomes something you have to declare in advance. So the mental model I want you to hold for the next half hour is simple. Every primitive is the automated substitute for a human's presence. Worth grounding where this sits officially. Claude Code GitHub Actions is built on top of the Claude Agent SDK, and it runs on GitHub's own runners. The docs put it plainly, your code stays on GitHub's runners. That's the substrate. Everything we talk about today, triggers, permissions, timeouts, is standard GitHub Actions machinery that the Claude action plugs into. Nothing here is exotic. It's the same plumbing every CI pipeline uses, just viewed through the lens of nobody being present when it runs. Let's start with the workflow file itself, because the file is the operator's runbook. Workflow files live in the .github/workflows directory, and they're YAML with a .yml or .yaml extension. There's no human to type the next command, so every action, every ordering decision, every guard has to be written down up front. Read the file top to bottom, and you're reading exactly what the machine will do. In the order it'll do it, at the top level, a workflow has a handful of keys. There's the name key, which is just the display name. There's the on key, which declares the triggers. There's a permissions block, which sets the scopes on the automatically generated GitHub token. There's an env block for variables shared across the workflow. There's a concurrency key for serialization. And there's the jobs key, which is a map of the actual jobs the workflow will run. Inside a single job, you get another layer of keys. The runs on key picks the runner label. The needs key declares dependencies on other jobs. The if key makes the whole job conditional. The strategy and matrix keys fan the job out into variations, the timeout minutes, key caps, wall clock time. A job can also carry its own permissions block that overrides the workflow level one, plus an outputs map, and of course, a list of steps. Inside a step, you've got a name, an ID that becomes the handle for reading, that step's outputs later. A uses key for a pre-built action like actions/checkout at version 4 or a run key for a shell command. You pass inputs to an action with block, you set step level env, and you gate the step with its own if the rule is that a step is either a uses step or a run step. Never both steps run sequentially in the same runner. And they share a file system, which matters a lot when we get to why jobs don't. Why does an unattended agent care about all this? Because the file is the runbook. No human is going to type the next command, so every action, every order, and every guard has to be declared up front. Now the on block, the triggers, because this is how the agent gets woken up in the first place. The first trigger is workflow dispatch, which is manual or API kickoff with typed inputs. The minimal form is just on workflow dispatch with nothing else. But you can declare inputs, and each input has a description, a required flag, a default, and a type. The type can be choice, Boolean, string, number, or environment. And when it's a choice, you supply an options list. Inside the workflow, you read those values through the inputs context or the GitHub event inputs context. You get up to 25 top-level inputs and a payload up to 65,535 characters. For an unattended agent, this is the on-demand launch. An operator or another piece of automation kicks off a Claude run with parameters, and it's your manual rerun escape hatch when something needs a do-over. The second trigger is schedule, driven by cron. You write on schedule with a cron entry, five fields like 30, then 5, then 1 through 5, which is the POSIX 5-field format, minute 0 to 59, hour 0 to 23, day of month 1 to 31, month 1 to 12, and day of week 0 to 6. A few things will bite you here. Cron runs in UTC, always, so translate from your local time, or you'll be an hour or several off. The minimum interval is once every 5 minutes. Scheduled workflows only run on the default branch, so a cron on a feature branch does nothing. In public repositories, the schedule auto-disables after 60 days of repository inactivity, and it's best effort, not real time. The top of the hour is the most congested slot on GitHub's schedulers, so stagger your crons a few minutes off the hour. For an unattended agent, this is the nightly run with nobody present. Triage the issues, update the dependencies, generate a report. The 60-day auto-decoral and the top-of-hour delay are exactly the silent failure modes you have to design around. Third is repository dispatch, which is an external API event. Some outside system post to the repo's dispatches endpoint with an event type and a client payload object. And inside the workflow, you read GitHub event client payload. You get up to 10 top-level payload properties. This is how an outside system, a monitoring tool, a deploy hook, another repository entirely, hands a task to a Claude run programmatically with no human in the loop at all. Fourth, the issues and pull request triggers, which together are the at Claude event surface. The issues trigger has types like opened, edited, labeled, and assigned, among others. The pull request trigger, if you omit the types filter, defaults to three types: opened, synchronized, and reopened. That synchronized type is worth calling out on its own. It means new commits were pushed to a pull request branch, so it fires on every single push to an open pull request. You can filter these triggers by types, by branches, and by paths. The canonical Claude example gates on issue comment created, pull request review comment created, and issues opened or assigned. Those are the events that carry an at Claude mention or an assignment the agent should react to and nothing else. Fifth is workflow call, which marks a workflow as reusable. When you write on workflow call, the workflow becomes callable from another workflow, and it declares typed inputs, secrets, and outputs of its own. The gotcha here is secrets. A called workflow does not automatically see the caller secrets. You either pass secrets inherit, or you name them one by one. The payoff for unattended work is real. You define one hardened build plus test plus Claude workflow once, and call it from many repositories or triggers. so your guardrails don't drift copy by copy across the org. One source of truth for the safety rails, instead of a dozen slightly different forks of the same YAML. Now jobs, runners, and how data moves between them. The runs on key with Ubuntu latest is the canonical GitHub hosted Linux runner. You've also got Ubuntu 24.04, Windows latest, macOS latest, and self-hosted labels for your own machines. Here's the critical fact. Each job runs in a fresh virtual machine and jobs do not share a file system. That's the whole reason artifacts, caching, and outputs exist to pass data between jobs that otherwise cannot see each other's disk at all. If you write a file in one job and expect the next job to read it off the same disk, you'll be surprised because that next job is a brand new machine. The matrix is your fan-out mechanism. Under the strategy key, you write a matrix with, say, a node version list of 18, 20, and 22, and GitHub generates one job per combination. By default, fail fast is true, which cancels the remaining combinations the moment one of them fails, and max parallel caps how many run at once. For an unattended agent, the matrix tests the agent's changes across node versions or operating systems in parallel, with nobody kicking off each variation by hand. You get broad coverage for free while you're asleep. The needs key sequences jobs. If you write needs build, this job waits for the build job to succeed before it starts. Without needs, jobs run in parallel. And if you want a cleanup job to run even when an upstream job failed, you give it if always, so it fires regardless of what came before it. The if conditional gates jobs and steps, you'll see things like if GitHub event name equals schedule, or if contains of the comment body and the @Claude string. There are status functions you lean on here, success, which is the implicit default, along with always failure and canceled. This if is how the agent decides, is this event actually for me, with no human to eyeball it? A loose condition means Claude runs on every comment which costs you money, or the condition is too tight and it never runs, which fails silently and you don't find out for a week. Outputs move state between those isolated jobs. A step writes an output by echoing a key equals value line into the GitHub output file, and then you read it as steps, the step ID outputs, the key name, a job declares outputs under its own outputs map, and downstream jobs read them as needs, the job name outputs, the key. That's how you pass a computed value from one job to the next without a human copy, pasting it across, which is the only other way isolated machines could share it. Let's talk secrets, variables, and environment secrets, because an unattended agent authenticates entirely from these. Nobody's there to type a password. A secret is read through the secret's context, it's encrypted at rest, and it's masked in the logs so it won't leak into your output. The Claude action reads its key as Anthropic API key from the secret's context. Never hard code a secret. The docs are explicit about that. A variable read through the var's context is for non-sensitive config, and importantly, it is not masked in the logs, so don't put anything sensitive in a variable thinking it's protected, because it isn't. Environment secrets are a step up from ordinary secrets. They're attached to a named GitHub environment, and that environment can require reviewers, a wait timer, or branch restrictions before a job is allowed to run at all. That's how you gate a deploy behind human approval inside an otherwise fully automated pipeline, a single checkpoint where a person signs off. There's also the GitHub token secret, which is auto-generated fresh per run with no setup on your part. You add all of these under settings, then secrets and variables, then actions. If you're running on Bedrock, you'll need an AWS role to assume. If you use a custom GitHub app, you'll need an app ID and an app private key. The through line, the agent, authenticates entirely from secrets and OIDC, because nobody types a password when it runs. Here's a piece of history that still trips people up. The default permissions on the GitHub token. On February 2nd, 2023, GitHub changed the default GitHub token permissions from read-write to read-only, but only for newly created enterprises, organizations, and repositories. Existing orgs and repos were not automatically changed. So what you actually get depends on when and where your repo was created, which is maddening. There's also a repo and org level. Workflow permission setting permissive, meaning read plus write versus restricted or read only, and you find it under settings, actions, general, and the permissions key itself. The one you write in the workflow file shipped back on April 20th, 2021. Why does an unattended run care about any of this history? Because if the default is read only and your workflow needs to push a branch or open a pull request, the run gets a silent 403 and there's no human watching to notice the failure. The fix is to declare the permissions block explicitly rather than trusting whatever the default happens to be. So let's nail the permissions block because it has one rule that surprises almost everybody. There are around 14 scopes, and each one can be set to read, write, or none. Actions, attestations, checks, contents, deployments, discussions, ID token, issues, packages, pages, pull requests, repository projects, security events, and statuses. Here's the rule. The moment you specify a permissions block, any scope you do not list is set to none. It's an allow list, not a patch. So writing a permissions block with just contents read doesn't only set contents to read, it strips write access from everything else at the same time. People add a block to grant one thing and accidentally revoke five others. You can set the permissions block at the workflow level where it applies to every job, or per job, where it overrides the workflow level for that one job. A least privileged build and test job wants just contents read and nothing more. The Claude Action's own example uses a broader set because it does more work. Contents write so it can push commits, pull requests write so it can open and update pull requests, issues write so it can comment, ID token write so it can mint an OpenID Connect token, and actions read so it can read your CI results. That ID token write permission is required to mint an OIDC JWT, a JSON web token. Without it, the token request just fails outright. This is where least privilege caps your blast radius, which ties straight back to our blast radius episode. Underscope and you get silent 403s. Overscope and a prompt injected agent has all the room it needs to do real damage. Now the big one. Cloud authentication with no long-lived keys using OpenID Connect, which everyone abbreviates OIDC. The concept, GitHub's OIDC provider issues a short-lived JSON web token, a JWT, for each individual run. Amazon Security Token Service, STS, exchanges that token for temporary credentials through an action called Assume Role with Web Identity. There is no stored AWS access key ID or secret access key anywhere in your setup. The credentials are minted just in time and they auto-rotate. Let me walk the three parts end to end so it's concrete. Part one lives on the AWS side. You register GitHub as an OIDC identity provider in AWS IAM. That's identity and access management. The provider URL is token.actions.githubyourtonside.com and the audience is stes.amazonaws.com. That's a one-time setup that tells AWS to trust tokens minted by GitHub. Part two is the IAM roles trust policy, and this is where the actual security lives, so slow down here. The principle is the federated OIDC provider, ARN for token.actions.githubyourtonside.com. The action allowed is assume role with web identity, and there's a condition, a string equals check on two claims. The audience claim must equal sts.amazonos.com. And the subject claim, the sub, must match your run's context. That sub claim is the security lever, the thing that decides which runs can assume this role. It takes forms like repo, then org/repo, then ref, then ref's heads main, which pins it to one branch, or repo, org/repo, environment production, which pins it to a named environment, or repo, org/repo, pull request, or the far too broad repo.org/repo*, which you should avoid. If you genuinely need wildcards, switch the condition from string equals to string like. Part three is the workflow side, and it's the easy part once the AWS side is right. Podcaster turns your reading list into a feed hands-free, but if you need something more general, studio-grade realism, narration for an audiobook or a long document, an API to build on, a premium text-to-speech tool will serve you better. I keep a current list of my favorites, and the picks change as the field does. See what TTS tools I prefer at ocdevel.com/voice. You set a permissions block with ID token write and contents read. Then you add a step that uses AWS actions /configure AWS credentials at version 4 with a role to assume ARN and AWS region like US East 1 and a role session name like GHA Claude Run. So the session is identifiable in logs. Then you verify it actually worked by running AWS SDS get caller identity, which prints back the identity you assumed. Why does an unattended run need all of this ceremony? An autonomous run can't hold a rotating password, and it really shouldn't hold a static one that lives forever. OIDC gives it just-in-time auto-expiring credentials scoped to exactly this repo, this branch, this environment, and nothing wider. Now, the pitfalls, because there are two classic ones. First, the subclaim has to match the run's actual context. A trust policy pinned to ref, ref's head's main will deny a run that happens on a pull request branch or inside an environment, and you'll get a not authorized to perform assume role with web identity error that sends people down a rabbit hole. Second and sneakier, a stray restrictive permissions block that forgets ID token write will silently break OIDC, because the token can't be minted in the first place, and the error you see is about credentials rather than permissions, which points you in the wrong direction. Concurrency groups keep two runs from stepping on each other. You write a concurrency key with a group and a cancel in progress flag. The group is the bucket, and you often key it by the workflow name plus the git ref, which makes it per branch, or by the head ref, which makes it per pull request. Runs that share a group serialize instead of running at the same time. If cancel in progress is true, starting a new run cancels the one already running. If it's false, which is the default, the new run queues up behind the old one. For an unattended agent, this prevents two runs from the same pull request or branch from double pushing or racing each other. Without it, a pull request that gets a lot of synchronized events, a lot of rapid pushes, spawns a whole pile of parallel clawed runs, all of them burning tokens and potentially creating conflicting commits on top of each other. Timeouts are, honestly, the single most important pitfall in this entire episode. So if you remember one thing, remember this one. The timeout minutes key at the job level cap's wall clock time, and a step can carry its own timeout too. Here's the number that matters. If you don't set it, the default job timeout is 360 minutes, which is 6 hours. Now, think about what that means with no human present. A person notices a hung job and cancels it inside a minute or two, because they can see it spinning. An unattended agent that loops or stalls just runs to that 6-hour default, spending billable actions, minutes, and API tokens the entire time, and you find out when the bill arrives. Always set a tight timeout minutes and pair it with a bounded max turns flag, so you're capping both the wall clock time and the number of agent iterations at once. Two different runaway modes, two different caps. Caching keeps your builds fast and cheap matters when you're paying per billable minute. The general purpose tool is action/cache at version 4. It takes a required path, a key that has to match exactly something like the runner operating system plus node plus a hash of your package lock file and a set of restore keys, which are ordered prefix fallbacks for partial hits when the exact key misses. The hash files function produces a SHA-256 hash, so the key automatically busts itself whenever your dependencies change, which is exactly what you want. There's a cache hit output that's true only on an exact match, which you can use to decide whether to bother running a clean install. For a TypeScript or Next.js project, there's a simpler path, actions/setup-node at version 4 with a node version set and cache set to npm. Handles the whole thing for you. 2. Caveats worth holding on to. A poisoned cache is a supply chain attack vector, so treat cache contents with a little suspicion. And pull requests from forks only get read access to the default branch's cache by design. So a fork can't poison your cache, but also can't populate it. Let me stitch all of this into the canonical end-to-end example from the docs, the AWS and OIDC workflow. It's named Claude PR Action. At the workflow level, it sets a permissions block with contents write, pull request write, issues write, and ID token write. Its on block listens to issue comment, pull request review comment, and issues. There's a job, call it Claude pre gated by an if, that checks whether the at Claude string appears across those event types. The steps run in order. First, actions/checkout at version 4 to get the code onto the runner. Then actions/create GitHub app token at version 2 with an app ID and private key pulled from secrets, producing a token output. Then AWS actions/configure AWS credentials at version 4 with the role to assume pulled from an AWS role to assume secret. And finally, Anthropics/Claude Code Action at version 1, given a GitHub token that points at that app token output, use bedrock set to true, and a Claude arg string carrying the model, oes.anthropic.claude.sonnet4.6 and max turns 10. There are two lighter variants worth knowing alongside that big one. The Direct API minimal version just uses Anthropic's / Claude code action at version 1 with an Anthropic API key pulled from secrets, no Bedrock, no OIDC, nothing else. And the scheduled autonomous version drops the at Claude gating entirely. It triggers on a schedule Crone 09 every day and hands the action a prompt like generate a summary of yesterday's commits and open issues with a Claude args of model Opus. That last one is the exact shape of a fully unattended nightly agent, a run that nobody starts and nobody watches. A few specifics on the Claude code action itself, version 1 since it has moved past beta. You pin Anthropics / Claude code action at V1, which is generally available now. If you're coming from the beta, there are breaking changes you need to know about. You move from at beta to at V1. You remove the mode input entirely because it's auto-detected now. The direct prompt input became just prompt. And several things that used to be top-level inputs, max turns, model, custom instructions, allowed tools, and disallowed tools, all move into the Claude args string as flags, max turns, model, append system prompt, allowed tools, and disallowed tools. The old Claude env input became a settings JSON blob instead. The auto detection is the nice part of version 1. It figures out whether it's in interactive mode, responding to an at Claude mention, or in automation mode, running immediately because you set a prompt. The key inputs are prompt, Claude args, Anthropic API key, which is direct API only and not for Bedrock or Vertex, GitHub token, trigger phrase, which defaults to at Claude, and the use Bedrock and use Vertex flags. Inside Claude args, the flags you'll reach for most are max turns, which defaults to 10, model, MCP config, allowed tools, and debug. One Bedrock wrinkle to remember, Bedrock model IDs carry a region prefix like us.anthropic.claudesonnet4.6. So don't drop the US prefix. To set all this up initially, you run install GitHub app in your terminal, which installs the Claude GitHub app, needs repo admin rights to do it, and adds the Anthropic API key secret for you. Let me close with the pitfalls listeners are going to hit, because these are the ones that quietly cost real time and money. The first is a subtle one. The GitHub token can't trigger downstream workflows. A pull request created or updated by a workflow using the default GitHub token does not create other workflow runs that are themselves triggered by the GitHub token. So, if Claude opens a pull request with the default token, your on-pull request CI simply won't run on it. The symptom people report is CI not running on Claude's commits, and they burn an afternoon on it. The fix is to authenticate with a GitHub app token via actions/create-github-app-token at version 2 or with a personal access token. That is exactly why the Bedrock example feeds the action a GitHub token from the app token output instead of the default one. This was the same pitfall we hit in the auto PR and label-driven episodes, so it should feel familiar. The second pitfall, the silent 403, a read-only default token plus an agent that tries to push or open a pull request equals a 403 that nobody notices. The fix again is to declare the permissions block explicitly, remembering that it's an allow list, and every scope you don't list becomes none. The third pitfall is the genuinely dangerous one, pull request target injection and secret exfiltration. Here's the distinction that matters. The pull request trigger runs fork code with no secrets and a read-only token, which is safe. The pull request target trigger runs the base repository's workflow with your secrets, a write token, and your org secrets, and it runs automatically even for a first-time contributor. So if you check out and then execute the untrusted pull request head under pull request target, an attacker can steal your secrets or gain write access to your repo. Never run fork pull request code in a privileged pull request target job. This ties directly to our prompt injection and blast radius episodes. The fourth pitfall we already covered, but it bears repeating because it's the expensive one. Forgetting timeout minutes means the 6-hour burn. Default is 360 minutes, and a stuck agent runs the full window, tight timeout minutes plus a bounded max turns. The fifth pitfall, secrets, are simply not available to fork pull requests. A pull request from a fork runs without your repo or org secrets, and with a read-only token, entirely by design. So an agent that relies on the Anthropic API key secret just won't have it on a fork pull request, and you have to plan for that rather than be surprised by it. The sixth pitfall is the OIDC submismatch we walked through earlier. Trust policy pinned to one context, the run actually happening in another, and assume role with web identity gets denied. Match the sub to the actual run context and reach for string, like when you genuinely need wildcards. And the seventh pitfall is the scheduled workflow that silently disables itself. Public repo cron auto-disables after 60 days of repository inactivity, and it only ever runs on the default branch. So your autonomous nightly Claude job can just quietly stop firing one day with no error to catch and no alert to page you. On cost, keep two separate meters in your head at once. There's GitHub Actions minutes, what you pay for GitHub hosted runners, and there's Claude API and token cost. They are two different bills. The levers, the docs, give you the same ones we've been discussing all episode. Use specific Claude commands instead of broad, open-ended ones. Cap iterations with max turns, cap wall clock time with timeout minutes, and use concurrency controls to kill redundant runs before they pile up. And one last practical note on versions before we wrap. Pin Anthropics / Claude Code action at V1, actions / checkout at V4, actions / create GitPub app token at V2, AWS actions / configure AWS credentials at V4. Actions / setup node at V4, and actions / cache at V4. For third-party actions especially, the hardened practice is to pin to a full commit SHA rather than a moving tag, so a compromised tag can't silently ship you new code inside your own pipeline. That's your GitHub Actions foundation. Every primitive we covered today, the triggers, the permissions block, the OIDC handshake, the concurrency group, the timeout, is standing in for a decision a human would otherwise make live in the moment. Declare them well, and the pipeline really does run itself. This episode was made with OC Devel Podcaster. You can turn anything into a podcast, a link, a document, or even a description of a topic you're curious about. And Podcaster researches and narrates it for you. Start your own at ocdevel.com/podcaster.